missing free throws. They couldn't hit a shot. Like it. Then they got away from feeding Terrace Reed.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how they pulled it off other than Duke just utterly choking. But I think I love about both these Final Four games is the fact that they're tight spreads. Like
I can see Michigan winning. I can see Arizona winning. I can see Illinois winning. I can see UConn winning.
Yeah, and then you're going to get to the title game, and there will be a larger gap. The gap in the spread of the title game will be more than the combined gap in the spread of these two Final Four games. So I think it's going to be an awesome, like, back-to-back window of games Saturday night. Like, the star power, the coaches, like, these are going to be two heavyweight fights. And even Illinois-UConn as the, quote, undercard, I mean, the schematic sort of X's and O's battle there between Dan Hurley and Brad Underwood, going to be really good. So I think we're in for two tight games. And in that situation, I gravitate more towards the better guards. And it's like Illinois has Keaton Wagler, and like Arizona has Jaden Bradley and Braden Burries. And Michigan's guards, like, I rag them a little bit. They have hit some big shots this year, like in key situations. But can they put a team on their back? Because Arizona has the physicality on the wing with Ivan Karchenkov to kind of body up Yaxel Lindeborg. And, you know, they could put a Koa Pete on Yaxel and physical enough to do it. Like, either one of those guys. Like, one of the rare players in college basketball with the combination of size and physicality and athleticism to actually kind of make life hard on Yaxel. So, I mean, yeah, that's a huge part of it. And then the other thing, it's like Michigan, you saw it against Tennessee. When they start to play in transition, it's like lights out. Well, Arizona offensive rebounds so well that you can't leak out. You can't get out in transition lest you leave yourself vulnerable to getting annihilated on the glass. And that's another check in Arizona's favor, is that Michigan's going to run a huge risk if they start trying to get out in transition, because if they're not sending five men to crash the boards defensively, Arizona's going to get a lot of second chance points.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into the list. We've got news about Curtis Givens' future. We'll talk about that and more from the world of sports when we come back. We'll also take a look at the NBA standings and what we need to root for. Basically, just keep rooting against the Magic. We'll talk about all that during hour number two. Jason Munns will kick off hour number three. Stick around and listen to Jeff Rett and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. I spent about an hour this morning going through all of the NBA standings because, let's be real, guys, we got eyes on the prize. It's all about the draft lottery. We got to figure out a way to get two choices in here. So I've taken a look at both the East and the West. Because I spent an hour on it, I'll tell you what I found during the next segment. We'll start off the third hour with Jason Munns. Before we do that, let's get in the list. Curtis Givens the third. This from On3's Joe Tipton. Curtis Givens the third is bound for the transfer portal, set to leave Memphis basketball after one season. Jason Munns writes, the 6'3" combo guard has two seasons of eligibility remaining. The Memphis native came to the Tigers after spending his freshman season at LSU. Givens is the second Memphis player this offseason to announce his intention to leave following a 13-19 campaign. Ashton Hardaway made his plans known on March 28th. We also have an update from the transfer portal tracker. No, beg your pardon. We also have another staff change, although I didn't really know what to make of this. Penny Hardaway also announced that he dismissed a member of his coaching staff from last season. According to the Commercial Appeal, director of scouting Joshua Townsend is the fifth staffer fired by the Tigers following the 13-19 campaign. In addition to assistants Jermaine Johnson, Mike Davis, and Roy Rogers, also strength and conditioning coach Todd Forcier, now Joshua Townsend will be the fifth member to go away. My problem on trying to render some type of verdict quickly when a guy like Givens leaves is you don't really know how the negotiation went one way or the other. I do think it's fair to say, I think Curtis Givens was a guy that, if we're talking about a formula that could feel more sustainable, a local product, a guy that can play, that is one that you'd want to keep. At the same time, we don't know anything about the financials of it.
Yeah, I think in an ideal world, you would keep him because you're losing Doug McDaniel, you're losing Sincere Parker. So it's like, all right, you got somebody there in Curtis Givens who showed some ability as a lead guard who actually had a pretty good effective field goal percentage. You know, he ended up shooting 36% from beyond the arc and was reasonably effective inside the arc, showed some distribution ability. Might have liked to have seen him cast in a bigger role, but at the same time, not somebody who you've seen enough from to where you would be willing to overpay.
And he also had the type of season that was up and down because of injuries. You know, he was banged up here and there. It's like it felt like he was kind of in a smaller version of the Aaron Bradshaw situation where it's like every time it felt like maybe you're thinking he's turning the corner, it's like there'd be another nagging injury.
Right. So, I'm with you, man. Ideal world, like you keep Curtis Givens, you keep Julius Thedford, you keep the two homegrown transfers who came in with a lot of eligibility remaining. They could be the core nucleus of your backcourt moving forward. I guess if I had to pick one or the other, I mean, I think Julius Thedford's going to fit in almost any system alongside almost any type of player because of the way he plays. And it's not necessarily a guy who's got to have the ball in his hands. And so if you can get a better lead guard in here, a proven lead guard, a productive lead guard, I'm not even saying it's got to be a PJ Haggerty or a Kendrick Davis level player. Preferably it would be. But if you can get somebody in that neighborhood even, then chances are, you know, Curtis Givens wasn't going to have the role that maybe he would have wanted.
Yeah, so if we're keeping track now, that means Ashton Hardaway and Curtis Givens are leaving the program. Thedford, William Wharton will be returning. Players that have been contacted by Memphis in the portal, Brock Meshack, who was at D2 West Texas A&M, a 6'3 guard, averaged 14.3 points, 4.8 rebounds, and 3.4 points or 3.4 assists per game. Also, Alex Atkinson, who was at D2 Claflin University. Do you have any idea where that is?
South Carolina.
I'm proud of you, buddy. I definitely had no idea. Caden Johnson, a 6'10 big man that was at Huntington University. That's an NAIA school, averaged 17.2 points and 11.4 rebounds per game. And Matt Gray, who was a junior at Davis and Elkins College. That's D2. No clue on that one. You got that one?
No, I don't. And I'll just say, like, the reason why these are non D1 guys who they've contacted is because the portal's not officially open. So don't get it twisted and think, oh gosh, they're only going after NAIA and D2 guys. Like, nah, these are probably studs at that level, who are able to be contacted at this point, you know, under NCAA rules.
Well, and the other thing about the portal is, we only know of like who has been reported on that is, you know, entered the portal or been contacted. Like that oftentimes means that the player themselves has to declare it, or let's be real, the agent has to declare it.
Right. So the portal officially opens next week. At which time, you know, you're going to see even more players declare, and then you'll start to see players officially contacted.
Has anyone set a line for number of names we're going to see?
You know, it gets a little murky because so many of these guys, a few hundred of them are like walk-ons who,
yeah,
you know, they barely count. Sorry. But
I don't even know what a walk-on is anymore.
Right. It's normally around 2,000 or so. And it's just a lot. It's a lot to keep track of. And it's like, you know, people want to crack on Ed Scott for saying he's got a university professor who's going to run an algorithm or whatever. And I get it, but you got to have some sort of service. Now there are actual legitimate basketball services out there who allow you to tailor the criteria when you're going through the portal to your tailor-made specifications. All right. I need somebody who's 6'6", who shoots 37% from three or better, who played D1 basketball last year. All right, you sort it by that. Okay, now give me somebody who also averages at least one steal per game, right? Like you can, you know, there's any number of ways that you can sort guys. Okay, now give me somebody who also played in the pick and roll 20% of his offensive possessions, right? Like, so you can, you know, there's any number of scouting services out there that can help you find players in that way. So whether it's an internal algorithm built by a professor or an actual basketball service, you know, there's ways to sort it that can help you identify your talent. And, you know, I hope Memphis is fluent in that already and not just waiting on somebody in the calculus department to figure it out.
Computer science.
Yeah.
Hendon Hooker. All right. So according to ESPN's Jeremy Fowler, Hendon Hooker has agreed to sign with the Tennessee Titans. Hooker, a third-round pick in the 2023 draft, was most recently with the Jets. He signed with the team's practice squad late in the 2025 season and was promoted to the 53-man roster back in January. The Lions previously had waived Hooker in August while reducing their roster to 53 players, and he signed with the Panthers practice squad a couple of days later. According to Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk, with the addition of Hooker, the Titans will have five quarterbacks on their offseason roster, with Mitchell Trubisky, Brandon Allen, and Will Levis, all behind number one overall pick Cam Ward. I was thinking about this. They all played at states that border Tennessee.
That's the first thing that came to my mind. It's like,
right?
Wow.
I don't know. I know Trubisky played at North Carolina. I don't know if he's from North Carolina, but like, I know he played college at North Carolina. Levis, I would assume, is from Pennsylvania or somewhere up north. Ohio, maybe. He feels
played
very Ohio.
Yeah. But I'm like, man, they're signing Hendon Hooker because they want to sell preseason tickets. Like,
right? Well, I was also thinking about this. So Will Levis plays at Kentucky. Brandon Allen from Fayetteville played at Arkansas. Is Hendon Hooker the most popular Tennessee quarterback since Casey Clawson?
Wow.
So the other options that I wrote down. So if we're going post Peyton, T. Martin's still going to be the most popular, right? Because he won the title.
A national title.
Correct.
Yeah.
And not even arguing that. So then we go to, do we go straight from T to Casey? I feel like was there a buffer in there?
Well, they tried to start AJ Suggs and Joey Matthews was a homegrown product. They tried to start him. And then Clawson
Casey took over.
The
job.
Yep.
All right. So then the other options that I had written down were Tyler Bray, Jonathan Crom-Tana.
I wondered if you had misspelled that.
No, I will never forget. Like when my Tennessee friends were starting to call him Jonathan Crom-Tana, which also Crompton is my first example of, Lane Kiffin can get pretty good production from any quarterback because Crompton was god awful, and then Lane gets him
fired.
Yes,
yeah. And then he was under Dave Clawson and was awful under Dave
in the Clawfence.
Yeah, and then
if I told you I was at the debut of the Clawfence when Tennessee I think it was my sophomore year. Tennessee plays at UCLA, and I can't remember if it was before my junior year, before my sophomore year, and like I went out to watch the game with my buddies, and then I was going back and forth. I went originally to root for Tennessee, despite the fact that I was sitting in seats given to me by my UCLA buddy. And then as soon as like it was so awful, I was like, I went and bought a UCLA shirt, and then I was like rotating back and forth based on whether or not they scored. But yeah, I saw the debut of the Clawfence, and that's when you realize like, oh, Fulmer's so not getting fired. The other option's Josh Dobbs.
So Hendon Hooker forever in Tennessee lore because he beat Alabama. That win over Alabama, over a Saban-coached Alabama team. One of the more iconic Neyland Stadium scenes maybe ever. Maybe the most iconic Tennessee home victory.
I mean, the only other one that rivals it, and we just didn't have as good of cameras, is 98 Florida.
98 Florida game. Yeah, similar situation. Field storming.
Jeff,
down the
I remember
post.
Jeff wrote a column about someone that he saw ripping up turf to keep the grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's there. When they ask you, why do they say it just means more? Because, yes, people will dig up the grass and put it in their pockets after a big win.
Oh, yes. I had one other addition to consider. Joey Aguilar before the Bama game.
I think Joey Aguilar had a chance and kind of blew it because he was like the anti-Nico.
Yes.
being the anti-Nico could have carried him a long way, but the season didn't really pan out, and now he's going to be gone just having played 1 year. It's between Dobbs and Hendon Hooker for most popular Tennessee quarterback, you know, of the 2000s. It's either Dobbs or Hooker because Hooker had the bigger win, but Dobbs was there for longer. And
Dobbs was like everything you wanted your starting quarterback to be. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
an aerospace engineering major.
And on top of that, he was good. He was good enough. Like, he carried himself like the quarterback of the team. He carried himself like a leader. You know what I mean? Like, he was easy to root for.
He masked a lot of deficiencies too, because their offensive line, especially those first couple of years, was awful. And because he was mobile, he carried him a long way. I think recency bias, if you put up a poll, you'd probably get more Hendon Hooker than Josh Dobbs. I mean, he did a lot. Like, he took him to the playoff. So, you know, I think, or he took him to the doorstep of the playoff. But I think in a narrow, narrow edge, I would go Hendon Hooker.
Got to give some love to the Pastrnak, though.
I mean, obviously, Dobbs has had one of those, like, banana land NFL careers, too, where it feels like he's going to be rich man's Josh Johnson, where it's like he's going to play for like 18 teams and start no more than two games for them. But like, he's had some insane games in the NFL.
Yeah. Isn't he on those commercials now where it's like the backup quarterback? I'm pretty sure
he's, is
have
that
a, seen a Dobbs one?
Is that a State Farm? No, yeah, Progressive. He is. It's like Bridgewater's had one. I swear Josh Dobbs has had one too.
Tennessee quarterbacks have done a great job of sticking in the league as backups. Tyler Bray in the league forever as a backup. Josh Dobbs in the league forever as a backup.
Nathan Peterman.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I've seen some games with these. Like, okay, so I saw a lot of Dobbs covering the team. I was actually in Memphis. Was it my freshman year? No. I can't remember exactly when Bray's tenure started, but you remember, I think it was the last time Tennessee played at Memphis in the Liberty Bowl. Tyler Bray was quarterback for that game, and that was like the beginning of his tenure, and he had a pretty nice day that day. I think he threw for four touchdowns maybe against the Tigers, and it was like, all right, this kid can play a little bit.
I just remember, who was the receiver he kept throwing to with the loco?
They had Derek Rogers and Justin Hunter.
Justin Hunter is who I was thinking of, but also Tyler Bray has one of the all-time horrific tattoos. The last name on the back of his shoulders in like the stars.
That dude was different. He's from California, and I'd love to see what the ACT score was.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's pondering the theory of relativity in his spare time. I also thought about considering retroactively considering Jarrett Garantano, Guantanamo Bay, because in hindsight, everyone realized that Pruitt did such a bad job with him, and like, he was so much better than all the other guys Pruitt tried to play.
Well, I got to give a lot of credit to both Jonathan Crompton and Jarrett Garantano, because they were both hated, maligned, like just crapped on by the fan base when they struggled. But somehow both have like endeared themselves to Tennessee fans in their post-playing careers. Like, both Crompton and Garantano do like podcasts and like multimedia stuff, like talking about the Vols, and like Tennessee fans follow them and like interact with them. And it's not just like, hey, you stunk. It's like, hey, good stuff. Like, you know, sorry. You know, everybody with the benefit of hindsight realizes there were bigger problems when those two quarterbacks struggled than just their own individual performance. And, you know, but I felt awful for Crompton, like, because he got so much. It was like the infancy of social media, and like, nobody knew how to like, well, Tennessee fans still, and most fans don't really know how to behave, you know, for the most part on social media.
Not online.
When it comes to SEC football.
It just means more.
Those two caught so much crap. So much crap. But they've actually, like, mended fences with the fan base.
No, I feel like part of it is like, and I wouldn't blame them, but it's like they never really lashed out.
Yeah. I mean, and Garantano ended up transferring out too, but yet still sort of wears that like VFL sort of badge, right? I think he ended up going to Washington State.
Oh yeah, he was a Coug.
Yeah.
I want to say he was a Coug in the. It was the year after COVID.
Right.
But he didn't play. He didn't win the job. I think he got beat out by. No, it was who was right there before. Who's the overrated kid from Texas that's the Oklahoma quarterback right now? Mateer.
John Mateer? Yeah.
Yeah. Who was... God, that Coug team stunk. That was like Rolovich. I can't remember if that was like Rolovich's...
Oh, Jaden DeLar.
Yeah. I can just see that guy just throwing it straight to a linebacker on third down each and every time. Tiger Woods. Okay, so we got the statement from Tiger yesterday saying, I know and understand the seriousness of the situation I find myself in today. I'm stepping away from a period of time to seek treatment and focus on my health. This is necessary in order for me to prioritize my well-being and work toward lasting recovery. I'm committed to taking the time needed to return to a healthier, stronger, and more focused place, both personally and professionally. I appreciate your understanding and support and ask for your privacy for my family, loved ones, and myself at this time. He also yesterday, via his attorney, Douglas Duncan, pled not guilty to the misdemeanor DUI charge that he received last Friday. So, a couple of things here. Number one, am I an a-hole for going, Tiger, why not leave out the very last sentence? I appreciate your understanding and support and ask for your privacy for my family, loved ones, and myself at this time. And I'm even talking about the last clause. I'm not saying that's an irrational request, but I do think a huge part of like why we are in this position is the constant desire of privacy and control.
Well, I'm just glad he's going to get help. Not that he has...
I don't know if he has much of a chance this time.
Yeah. The whole thing is like, is sad. And I want to say this too. Like, it makes you appreciate the Gary Woodland story all the more.
No, it is. And it's funny because they're both Steiny clients. And,
couldn't handle their challenges more differently. Like, Gary Woodland, like, you can see it. Like how hard it was for him to like open up and ask for help in its different circumstances.
Yeah, and
right?
to be clear, Gary Woodland has never been under the microscope that Tiger Woods has.
Right, but it's still weird.
Yes, it was very. It was
vulnerable.
It was also a striking contrast of Friday, we get the news, and then Sunday he wins for the first time since the U.S. Open in 2019.
I mean,
2 weeks after he did the sit down with Golf Channel about. You know, the PTSD right. struggles that he's gone through.
Make a
he also had brain surgery.
Right. And so
he's also, by the way, absolutely roasting the golf ball.
196 mile an hour
insane!
Ball speed
with
at 42 years old. What?
He is. I always hate when golfers. I used to laugh when my brother and I, the first time we saw Brooks, he was at the FedEx. And remember the whole like, guy could play linebacker. And I'm not a big guy. My brother's on the bigger side. He's like 6'1", 220. Like, he's stout. And you see Brooks and you just laugh. Like, that guy might be an NFL punter.
I mean, same for Gary Woodland.
But Woodland is the one guy, if you want to say the guy's athletic, I will take it because he did play JUCO basketball.
Yeah, he's on
D3. Was it D3?
Or was it? What was one of those little community colleges?
I always mix up him and Sudeikis. Sudeikis played JUCO, but I want to say maybe Gary started at a D3 school and then transferred to Kansas to play golf.
Was he at Washburn? He might have been at Washburn.
Yes, Washburn.
Yeah. So
D2. Sorry, Gary.
Like, I don't know. I also just can't totally. I find it hard to give up on. Like, I still want the Tiger story to have a happy ending. And I'll also say this, too, man. I don't know how you feel, but I watched at least a decent amount of the TGL. And now, in hindsight, knowing what I know, like, the signs were there, man. Like, the puppy eyes. He was dripping in sweat.
Well, I want to go
dripping in sweat.
I want to go back to on my old Twitter account, Once Upon a Time. Before the California wreck, where he nearly loses his leg. On that Saturday, he went and did the booth interview. It's his tournament, whatever. The tournament benefits his foundation, and he's there with Nance, and I think it's Faldo at the time. And the whole time, like, he's slurring. eyes aren't, you know, eyes are glossed over. And I got his fired off like, he looks horrible. And that was the post-2019. And I think a lot of us were guilty of it, which was you realize when he is back and in it, it is a different universe. Like 2019 Masters, like even compare it to the best story probably post that's Rory last year. And it's not even remotely on the same level. And we did the thing where probably overly critical of him post-scandal. And then we did the thing of when we got him back in 2019 or 18 and into 19, we really just like buried our head in the sand. Because, I mean, a lot of people were doing that. If you said anything critical, like, what are you doing? Like, do you know what it was like to not have him? We got him back. Like, stick with it. And that's where I do think the criticism, like the criticism of media is at least fair to ask, but the acting like this was somehow like the media's fault, it was insane to me.
Well, it's like I wanted to believe, like when I'm watching this TGL stuff and you see like the fun side of Tiger and like the later career Tiger has been so good about like having good relationships with other players and like he's tight with JT. And so sort of by proxy, you're able to.
Oh, he's tight with JT.
Yeah. So in your mind, you're able to create this. I know, right? This image of Tiger you can create because, oh, he's cool with JT. He cracks jokes with Justin Thomas on the court. He and Tom Kim and Kevin Kisner and Max Homa, this team they have in the TGL, Tiger's talking about their camaraderie and they're always cutting up and they're laughing. And so like, in a way, it's like Tiger's able to like clean up his reputation by proxy because all these other golfers who don't have these problems, who we watch and respect and know, are like, they're cool with them and like they're friends with them. And we're like, all right, well, like Tiger must be doing all right because like he's buddies with these people. Right. And then so it's like, but is Tiger, is that just like a strategy for him to like try and act like everything's okay by cozying up to some of the other big time players to make it look like, hey, everything's fine in my life. Like I've got good relationships with these players. I'm involved in these different business ventures. Like, and like, you got to live your life, right? Like you can't.
I would argue it was not a calculated thing. Because if he just goes and befriends Homa, then I'd listen to that because Homa has a very high approval rating. But JT's pretty polarizing. It's not like just being friends with JT like gets you, like you're not just getting like the JT bump, if you will. I do think him being away from golf, like his only in his life, like his only like social interactions were either people that are wanting something from him or the guys that he's playing golf with. And so the guys that he's playing golf with don't really want anything from him other than probably to play golf with him. And so I think there was an element of that. I also just keep wondering how much of it is it a 365-day addiction or was it, hey, man, I'm feeling okay enough. Let's see if I can ramp up and play the Masters. And then, you know, to try and ramp up and play the Masters, he's hammering the Vicodin. Like, yeah, I've wondered, like, if it, because I'm not, and I'm saying I have no idea. I've always just wondered how much of it is when he's trying to get back in golf shape because his body probably feels god awful. I mean, that was the other thing in the police report. 20 leg surgeries, 7 back surgeries. It's like, even if you do like the timeline, and you like, you kind of know, it's like, it's jarring to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's remarkable that the dude was able to hit. I mean, you watch him in the TGL stuff after 27 surgeries, he's still ramping up to nearly 180 mile an hour ball speed at age 50.
Yep.
I mean,
but having talked to people that have played golf and experienced the painkiller problems, they always say the full swing feels awesome, but watch the touch. And remember when he had the chipping yips?
Well, and he missed a three-footer when he
played.
That's
what I'm saying. It was the putt. The putt, that was when I was like, oh, boy. And then when they interviewed him, it left no doubt.
Yeah. It's, the human part of me, like, I think when I was younger and it was more like, I don't know, in a sad way, like, I'm not proud like to say, but I was like a teenager and he was first kind of, his reputation was first kind of running afoul, right, with the initial stuff. It was like, whoa, this is kind of wild, kind of like, it was more amusing. Now it's just like, it's just sad, right? Because you realize too that it's connected, because he burned, you know, he crashed his marriage. And the difference between Tiger today and Gary Woodland today is like, Gary Woodland is fighting because he, because of his family, because of the support that he has from his wife, like, because of like them, that's why he's so vulnerable.
What if he never,
and, like, Tiger doesn't have that. Tiger doesn't have that.
No. And I mean, some of it's by design. Like, he has the people in his life that are probably not going to tell him anything. Like, that's kind of where you struggle, like, really balancing it, because I can have the competing thoughts of, like, a lot of this is self-inflicted. But also, there's no other person in his sport that everyone wants a piece of like they do him. Not LeBron, not Steph, not Brady. Like, think about, like, how many generations, and, like, anytime we have anything in the sport, like, hey, we got to fix the tour. All right, let's get Tiger in here. Hey, we're launching a new TaylorMade driver. Let's get Tiger in here. Like, he is just a different level. And so I can sympathize with that has to be a tough life. But at the same time, it's like, hey, man, just because you like, you know, driving your Land Rover and listening to 90s rap, like, you might have to give the keys to somebody else.
Yeah, I think that safe driver tag on his license,
that's tough,
should be permanently revoked.
Yeah, that's tough. All right, I looked at the NBA standings. I've broke them down. I will tell you what we have to root for to make sure we get two lottery picks. We'll talk about it next right here on Jeff Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. All right, Cobb, consider this your, once you get done with this weekend, NBA, where are we? I don't know if I'd call it a preview, but status report.
All right, I'm ready. I need you to break it down for me.
All right, so let's start in the West. Oklahoma City, OKC leads the Spurs by 2.5 games. They have 6 games remaining. The Spurs have 7. The Thunder must stay ahead of the Spurs because they lost the series, the season series. The Thunder do have trickier games left, but that's kind of tough to pass. So it feels like we're pretty much headed to OKC getting the 1, San Antonio getting the 2. The Lakers hold a 2-game lead over Denver with 6 remaining. They also hold the tiebreaker over Denver. They do, however, have 2 games against the Thunder. So it's possible that the Nuggets could jump the Lakers, but it's pretty unlikely. 1, 2, and 3 are pretty firmly set. Here's where we start to get into... here's where it starts to get muddy for the West. Denver currently holds at the 4 seed. Denver clearly holds a game and a half lead over the Timberwolves and the Rockets. However, they have the tiebreaker against both. Houston does also play Minnesota the Friday before the end of the season. So game number 81, that series is currently split. So it kind of feels like the way each team's trending, whoever wins that game is going to get the 5. Denver will get the 4. The Suns are likely to hold on to the 7 based on gap. The Clippers currently lead the Blazers by 0.5 game for the 8th seed. The teams will meet in Portland on April the 10th. The Clippers currently lead the series 2-1. But based on the way these two teams are trending, Portland very much could wind up with that 8 spot. Portland currently holds a 2-game lead for the 9 seed over the Warriors, and they hold the tiebreaker. So the Warriors are basically going to finish 10, and it feels like, based on current form, Suns will get the 7, Portland's going to maybe jump to the 8, Clippers will be the 9. So our play-in games would be Clippers hosting the Warriors. Then we would have Suns hosting Portland. The loser of Suns-Portland would host the winner of Warriors-Clippers. Pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward. Right. The West is clean. All right. Now let's go to the East and what actually matters to the Grizzlies, because let's just figure out how to get Orlando out of there as soon as possible.
We need Desmond Bane to work some magic for us.
Or maybe, like, get another toe injury. So right now, the Detroit holds a 4.5 game over lead with Boston with 6 games to play. They also play the Bucks and Indiana. They are likely to hold on to the 1 seed. They also hold the tiebreaker against the Celtics. They basically would have to lose out. The Celtics would have to win out. So the Celtics currently have a 2.5 game lead for the 2nd seed over the Knicks. They have 7 games remaining. The two teams will play at the Garden on April 9th. I believe that's the first night of a back-to-back on that last 3 games of the season. The Knicks currently hold the season series at 2-1. So the Celtics have to stay a full game in front of the Knicks, because if they wind up even, the Knicks would get the tiebreaker and move up to the 2. But right now, 2.5 games with 7 to play, despite the fact that you play each other, that seems pretty sizable. The Knicks, for the 3 seed, currently hold a 1-game lead over the Cavs with 6 games remaining. Cleveland, however, does hold the tiebreaker over New York, so it's entirely possible that the Cavs could wind up in the 3, the Knicks bump down to the 4. But when you look at the remaining schedule, the Knicks have a softer schedule than the Cavs. It seems likely that they're going to win. Now let's get to the jumbled mess of Atlanta, Toronto, Philly, Orlando, Miami, and Charlotte. Are you ready?
Let's go.
The Hawks hold a half-game lead over the Raptors currently for the 4 seed. However, the Raptors do have the tiebreaker over the Hawks. For the 5th seed, Toronto holds a 1-game lead over Philadelphia. I'm sorry, this Atlanta for the 5 seed, Toronto for the 6 seed. Toronto holds a 1-game lead over Philly. The Raptors also have remaining games against Sacramento, at Memphis, and against the Nets. They also do play Boston and New York, and they host Miami twice. But right now, their advantage is pretty significant. The most likely outcome for Toronto is either they jump Atlanta or stay at the 6. So then we get Philly, Miami, Orlando, Charlotte, who are all separated at this point in time, I believe, by a game. Let's see. 13.5. A game and a half. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, we got Orlando, Miami, and Charlotte all have 40 victories.
Correct. Philly currently holds the 7 seed by 1 game. They would win tiebreakers against Charlotte and Orlando. However, they would lose a tiebreaker against Miami. Orlando currently holds the 8th spot by a half of a game. They also only have 1 game remaining against the clustered teams. That is Atlanta tonight. Very easy. Go Hawks.
Right.
Very simple. Orlando only wins a tiebreaker against Miami. They would lose a tiebreaker against Atlanta, Charlotte, Philly, Toronto.
So you're saying there's a chance they could end up as the 10?
Oh, I think I might want some odds and bet on that.
And that's best case scenario, clearly, for the Grizzlies.
That would mean Orlando would then go to whoever the 9 is, and even if they won the game, they would then have to go play the loser of the 7-8 game to make the play-in and therefore be outside of the lottery.
You're saying, what are we looking at? 50-50 odds that Orlando ends up in the lottery, therefore the Grizzlies end up with a second lottery pick?
So right now, the Magic have only a 25% chance to make the 8, and they have essentially about a 54% chance of being 9 or 10. Having to win 2 games,
right?
Likely with at least one on the road, if not both on the road, I would think it's more like 55-45.
Well, that's best case. I just did a lottery spin on a Tankathon, and it came out sort of not what you're envisioning in terms of Orlando actually makes the playoffs in this scenario, and that's the 16th overall pick. But in this spin, the Grizzlies jumped up to number one.
Funny that you mentioned that. I myself just did that, and it would be the Grizzlies taking DeBanza. So this is the question that I have for you. Does it feel like now DeBanza, does it feel like he has passed Peterson and will stay there?
I don't feel that way. For all the discourse around Darren Peterson this year, it doesn't seem as though the NBA scouts have been firmly budged off viewing him as a potential number one overall pick. Now, I've always been of a camp that AJ DeBanza is a safer pick, but I mean, unless sentiment has been shifting and I'm just unaware of it over the last 2 weeks, like it still feels to me as though Darren Peterson should be the betting favorite to be the number one overall pick.
So where I think Peterson could have a problem was his offensive game entering the season was considered to be significantly better than DeBanza. DeBanza now, it feels like even if you believe that Peterson's offensive game's better, I think DeBanza exceeded expectations offensively this year.
You know, and now that I look at it on real time, like I guess there are some odds out there that have AJ as like the betting favorite. And that to me, it makes more sense. Like, and probably for basketball reasons more so than the like health concerns, because those were always like the kind of the red flags for me. But then, like, you've got a guy there in AJ DeBanza who, unbelievable all year, all American caliber player, leading scorer in the country, scores at all three levels. Like, there's really no holes in his game. And it's a shame that BYU wasn't a better team because he never really got the chance to felt like showcase it on the national stage. Like, whereas, like, Kansas was appointment viewing, even if, or if for no other reason, to see if Darren Peterson
was going to play
and play the whole game. Right. And so, but I mean, if AJ's trending towards being the number one overall pick, then so be it. Like, I don't have any problem with that whatsoever.
To be clear, these odds change quickly. But as of right now, over at DraftKings, AJ DeBanza is -180 to be the number one overall pick.
Wow. I mean, so that's shifted a lot. That's shifted a lot within the last couple of weeks. I mean, as recently as a month ago, it still felt like Darren Peterson was somehow viewed as a lock to go number one overall. And I felt like I was out on an island by saying that AJ DeBanza could go or should go number one. And clearly that sentiment is shifting. I get it. Like I totally understand why.
When we come back, we will talk with Jason Munns. Let's get the update on everything that has been happening Tiger basketball, including the news about Curtis Givens entering the transfer portal, the new assistant coaches, as well as a new women's basketball coach. We'll talk about all of that with Munns when we come back right here on Jeffrey Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN.